Hi, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the co-author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a rich and ongoing public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a real role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now conducted a little over 100 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by Junpo Dennis Kelly Roshi. We're going to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled Falling in Love with Death. The way this will work is I'll introduce Junpo and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes, perhaps a little more. Junpo Dennis Kelly Roshi is the 83rd patriarch in his lineage of Rinzai Zen. He began his Buddhist practice at Zen Center San Francisco in the early 70s, later becoming a student of Edo Shimano Roshi in New York and subsequently a monk. He received Inca from Edo Shimano Roshi in 1992. Interested in bringing his Zen Rinzai lineage into American culture without the Japanese cultural bindings, Junpo left the monastery and founded the Lay Buddhist Hollow Bones Order, of which he is the abbot. He also created Mondo Zen, which integrates processes for emotional maturity and insight with meditative awareness. He established Hollow Bones 7-day Zen retreats for the Mankind Project also. And he's also a yoga instructor, where he traces his lineage to BKS Iyengar and Patabi Joyce. That's his official biographical paragraph as a teacher. But there's a lot more to his story. The biography written by Keith Martin Smith, A Heart Blown Open, introduces a very intense, fierce, passionate wild man who played a major role in the hippie revolution, a lover of many women, now happily married to Acharya Mary Connolly. A Vietnam-era military man who, for a time, was a major LSD manufacturer hunted by the FBI and who served time in federal prison. What I appreciate most about Junpo, though, is none of that. It's the fact that he's so willing and capable of stepping right through his story into immediate, vulnerable contact with himself, with the moment, and with me. Including many things that people, especially teachers, tend to want to hide, like fear, dysfunction, confusion. He gave me a call a few months ago, and we had a profoundly intimate and raw conversation. Since we had last spoken, he had received his Parkinson's diagnosis, and he'd had his symptoms and got the diagnosis, and he shared with me what that was like, including the whole thing, in the most raw and real terms. And so we just dropped in intimately, two real live, living and dying body minds in the midst of an amazing adventure, both of us enjoying the wild ride that is this life while waking up to what doesn't die, sometimes amidst excruciating pain, and just being present with each other. He was willing to have a real conversation that might edge into something new, and to have a new conversation right now that might go places we can't predict. Not just a series of monologues, not something that's been said before. And so that's why I invited him to have this public dialogue with me. So welcome, Junpo. Thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's my great pleasure. And when I heard the title Beyond Awakening, I started laughing because this is our job. So, like, you know, waking up, getting a little insight is easy. What do you do with it? How do we transform our person? How do we integrate that into conscious embodiment and then serving in the universe? So the Beyond Awakening, it's a great koan for us all, great riddle. What does that mean? And how do we do it?
Yeah. Well, how are you doing today?
One day at a time. I'm doing great. I woke up this morning, and, you know, in the mornings for me, I call it the crypt. I wake up in the morning, and, you know, the symptoms from the radiation and the cancer treatment, intense, you know, 4 months of that, 8-9 years ago now, it's all getting a little more interesting. In the Chinese tradition, they say, may you live in interesting times. It's a great curse. So the whole morning is a process of radical self-acceptance and opening more and more into the heart and looking and being with what is. And that usually takes me about 30 minutes. This morning, I think it was about 31 minutes where I get through the fog, you know, deal with it all and get things organized. And it's such a gorgeous day here today. It's just like, you know, so things are, you know, really pretty good right now. And on we go.
Yeah. You know, I remember when we talked, one of the things that particularly touched me was you were explaining how one of the symptoms of the Parkinson's is that it's harder for you to talk, that when you speak in a way that feels normal to you, your voice is very, very soft, and it's almost like you have to shout. How is that right now?
Well, I'm shouting. It's really interesting, and this is the more I learn about Parkinson's, the less I want to know. But what happens is the body shuts down, and so what happens is to speak normally, I have to put more effort in. And so I've been to voice class and therapy for that, and they got interesting therapies for the symptoms. And so that's just something I have to remember, like I speak publicly. And when I'm doing that, so I just have to remember that it's more like I'm shouting, you know. And if I'm shouting, then everything is fine. People hear me normally. So that's just, again, part of the discipline of the new way of being in the world. And one of the problems, it's fatiguing. You know, I give an hour talk and try to keep them under an hour. I've always done that because people get bored. After, you know, what can you say for more than an hour? And but to maintain the integrity of that practice, it takes more muscle, takes more concentration. So it's a little more, it's physically exhausting.
Right. And, you know, just settling into this, you've been you're a guy who's really taken a deep bite out of life, you know, every step of the way, in a sense, being just a kind of a wild stomper. And there's something in your, you know, having lived very fully and practiced very intensely and had the opportunity even to come into certain kinds of, I don't know if conflict is the right word, but you entered into a very traditional Japanese approach to practice and ended up realizing that you had to evolve it if you were to make it really relevant and high integrity in relation to your own experience and the experience of other contemporary Western educated people. So you've broken through. You know, one of the things that I think of when I think of you is this fierce kind of impact of breaking through a veil, like the shock of the shout, the Zen shout, kind of breaking through veils again and again. And that is like the force of life, you know, life breaking through veils and waking up, you know, these are all the force of life. And yet the totality is the cycle of life and death. And you've talked about this whole process of dealing with these symptoms and these different standoffs you've had with potentially lethal conditions, you know, fatal conditions. And I'm just kind of wondering if, yeah, I want to invite you to speak, you know, a little more length on this dance of the, there's the updraft of that breaking through with that awakening and this downdraft of opening and softening into the inevitable two-sidedness in which we're not just affirming life, we're also allowing the cycle of life and death.
Yeah, I call it radical self-acceptance. It's like, first of all, traditionally, we have to wake up. We have to become more conscious. And the traditional way for that, a Zen school is a dhyana yoga school, a meditation school. Zenna is how the Japanese say chana. Chana is how the Chinese say dhyana. Dhyana is the second point in the classic meditative practice. Dharana, concentration practice. Concentrate, stay present. Use a mantra, yantra, or koan process to stay absolutely fiercely present. Don't look away. Wake up, wake up, wake up. And then, so you're waking up, but you're still left with the psychological emotional structures and systems that are there. So then what do you do with that? You study, you go deeper, and eventually with koans or the practices become the precepts, but they're outside structures. So it's like, how do you get deeper? Okay, so it's promised. You have kensho or spiritual awakening moments, but how do you get to satori, which is the integration of that awakeness in the context of your life? And so I discovered that it didn't do that for me, and it didn't do that for many, many of the students that I worked with. So what do we do? How do we get meaning and understanding and bring that awareness, that deeper clarity, into our lives? What does it mean? So it's like I say, falling in love with death, to go witness deeper and deeper from a clearer and clearer, deeper place. Where views and opinions just fall aside. What's left is an incredible intensity of awareness. And then you look at what's going on. And like I say, falling in love with death, this is not exactly the way to say it. It's like standing in love with death. I've always teased people about saying falling in love. You're in danger. Don't fall in love with death. Stand up in love with, or don't fall in love with someone. Stand up in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that perspective of leaning in. And so with this situation, it becomes overwhelming. I've got Parkinson's, I've got neuropathy and fibrotic tissue because of the radiation and the chemo and all of this noise in the body, right? And it puts me in my sympathetic nervous system. My body is afraid. I had a bike accident and I fell down the stairs at the Y going for a swim one day, about a year ago. These are symptoms. The body, doesn't have the neurotransmitters, the mind and the body relationship. So you go to take a normal movement, your body does something else. So then you go in and your body goes into flight and fright. I got to move smaller. I got to move slower. So how do you get inside that? How do you move inside that realization and reality and function differently?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I discovered that, okay, so don't turn away from it. And if you come to a non-dual depth or realization, you see that this intensity of experience is simply that, and good or bad are relative interpretation. But from a divine perspective, it's just combustion. It's just life and death. They're the same. It's the evolution and unvolving of spirit as matter, and then awareness intersecting with species of beings, and ever evolving. But from this deep point of view, it's all the gift of life and death. So in the beginning, there's silence, purity, and emptiness. And at the center of our being right now is silence, purity, and emptiness, beyond comprehension. The mind just stops here because the mind is a relative mechanism. And the soul, as the relative mechanism, is a temporary construct. As a vast, empty potentiality, this is who we are, fundamentally, divine. But how do you come to that realization? And then from that realization point, you suddenly look out, you look at everything, you look at this going on, and it's incredibly interesting and beautiful. So death is boo-hoo from a relative perspective of egocentric and biophysical need to continue. But from a depth of pure witnessing, it's the most amazing thing. this is all constructed, and then as the systems break down, you're dying. The systems are failing, and they're going into absolute disappearance. And that's uncomfortable physically and really irritating psychologically until you get the joke, until you get that deeper understanding and perspective. And then you come back to it, and it's like, yes, the sadness is there and the grief is there and all that's going on, but you're no longer subject to it in the same way. So again, that celebration of life and death, in and out. We arise spontaneously and miraculously from silence, and we deconstruct and go back into the period of silence or naked spirit, I would say. So then the question is how to go about doing that and how to integrate that. So say, well, what are you doing with your formalized practices of spiritual inquiry? And it begins the whole discussion and dialogue process. And now I've been through that. I've been up and down, in and out. And I did this repeatedly years ago, back in the 60s, when LSD I found as a vehicle for total deconstruction and you could say even annihilation of ego. But not understanding that, then I had to come back and do a great deal of therapy and psychological inquiry and studying the various yoga systems and meditation systems to finally be able to language it and voice it and build a structure that allows a vehicle or a way to take this deeper, deeper in and in and in, get a shift in understanding and a transformation of being. So this is what I'm saying, and now I'm in love with my death. Does that make any sense from a relative perspective? What can that possibly mean? The most amazing thing happens to me. I'm an old Roman Catholic boy who got thrown out repeatedly, finally had to leave because I couldn't accept a lot of the faith game that was played. I wanted to, and I couldn't. So, great arguments, right? And now what happens is when I turn and actually open and radically accept what's going on, right? I smile right in the face of these conditions and circumstances, and I say, thank you, my Lord. That little voice just comes up from nowhere. Thank you for the insights. Now, what is that? Is that like some kind of abstraction, projection, or is that echoing something deeper? So that was just interesting. So I'm almost returning to my theistic roots.
Yeah. I'm appreciating both the kind of the teaching of radical consciousness and radical freedom that I know so well from not just Zen but other jnani paths, other paths both in Buddhism and Hinduism, Taoism. And yet, for me, that radical perspective can be embraced and tends to be often embraced when people are young and first on the path in a way that involves a certain amount of spiritual bypassing, because, of course, it's the coincidence of the relative and the absolute. The form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and then finding our way to truly, artfully, actually show up in each of these moments as the unique beings that we are, with our unique soul potentials and our unique purposes and creative gifts to give and our potentials and possibilities and limitations and circumstances, and doing that in a way that is neither continually binding attention to the form of the mechanics of life, continually awakening from that mere mechanics, but still not just standing apart from life. It's somehow awakening into life more fully. And because you're a guy who's really lived life, passionately. You still, one of the things I enjoyed in our earlier conversation was when you began trying to get me into tango dancing because you enjoy it so much. So there's
the
something.
Real dance, the real dance of life is tango, Argentine tango.
Yeah. Well, I want to kind of talk with you about the fine strokes here as you're both awakening into that freedom and finding what it is that is important at this time in your life and actually living the life that you're given in these days with the neuropathy and the shakes and the things that are so difficult and you know, getting the joke, but not just in a way that removes you, but laughing your way into the moment, in a sense, into the fullness of what's possible.
Well, what's happened is this is just a given. What happens is your heart breaks open, doesn't break closed, and your heart breaks open in unconditional love. It's like, you know, there's a conditional loving, you know, based on morality and ethics and what I should do, and then like Homo sapiens survival patterns. You know, we live in groups and caves, so we'd be nice to each other, and you know, all of that. But there's a level of love that, like I say, takes no prisoners. So it's standing up in love. It's embracing and living in radical truth and communion. And like, I say, okay, what are we interacting with in arm's reach? What do we eat? What do we consume? You know, what's really going on in our relationships? Mm-hmm. Are we extending love and compassion, service and interaction? Are we celebrating gift of life and being with one another? You know, do we recognize our potential and possibility upon the path? And then how what's up? What are you doing with your family? You know, what is your life? What have you found meaning? Like, you and I have had this great gift somehow, you know, to be a voice in the world. We have a vocation. So vocationally, you know, we're compassionately, to the best of our abilities, as far as I know about you and for me, you know, extending that service into the world. And I really think that's what it's all about,
mm-hmm.
How to live richly and fully and compassionately from the realization of the purity of the emptiness and the deeper spirit, right? And the truth. And it's, you know, it's where the kingdom of heaven lies within you. Be still and know that I am God. You know, Sat Nam. I am that I am. So it's like all of these things suddenly makes sense, not as a philosophical construct or as an idea, not as another book for the coffee table, but in the quality of the interaction in life. And suddenly, feeling is no longer problematic. You open to the depth of feeling, you know, but you don't neurotically drag it around. Feel, like when you look at our culture, for instance, I say the great world religion today is imperial capitalism. Look at the price of that in the world. Don't fail to look at the goodness of it in the world, but look at that and how, okay, and then how do I radically self-accept that from the viewer point and say, okay, and then here's what I can do, and lean back into the wind, knowing that evolutionary speaking and karmically speaking, in Buddhism, we have something, tathagata garbha, or suchness, or isn't. And like Trungpa used to say to me when I was studying with him, see the perfection. See the perfection. You know, he was talking about that realization of everything being as it is and must and unfolding and accepting it and at the same time moving forward. Now, he, again, was developed beautifully and insightful in some ways, but he was not. He was a little confused in others. But how do we, you know, come back to the grace and the gift of life and live compassionately and fully? In all directions. Koan. And where are you not? And if you're not, then what is your discipline? What is your way of returning to this depth of understanding?
You know, I'm feeling the meanings of each thing you're saying as we are deepening into this. And you know, feeling the aches and pains in my own body, the kinds of issues that I'm challenged with, tending to create a storyline that can express itself as a kind of self-concern. I'm feeling the intimacy of that which is, most real, most close, the mystery itself, the consciousness that I am, and that which is beyond words, which Buddhism would never name, but which others of us call God, and feeling how in each moment there is, it's alive, that I wake and re-wake again, and that it's not a matter of remembering something, it's a matter of discovering freshly that which I have discovered so many times before, and yet it's always a new moment of authentic opening and discovery. And I there's a sort of softening into contact with the sadness and the pain and the loss at the same time that there's a opening in joy to the magnificence and beauty and amazingness of it all. And I'm feeling all of that in relation to you and to the vulnerability, that's just there in your voice as you shout. And we speak of these, it's so weird because as soon as Dharma is sort of stated and it becomes, a catechism, something about it is dead, it has to come alive again and again. And I'm feeling my call is to try to make this come alive in a way that's really useful for everyone who's listening and for me, for this to be authentic. And I'm feeling that as a living process here, as we're speaking with one another, really trying to listen at the deepest levels, really allowing this moment to be a moment in which maybe something awakens, not in you or in me, but in us, in the between and in the space of everyone else's listening.
Yeah, and for me it's a description of the compassion. It's like, that's one of the things that we shared when we first started talking. Both of us are driven. We're being driven.
Mm.
Going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's our karma, unfolding. And so it's like, okay, we really listen. And the first koan that I use, and koans are these enigmatic riddles. The first koan that I've used or created working with people is, can you purely listen? Can you listen with no opinion? Can you go deeper than your opinionated listen? If you can, you'll come to a depth of compassion. And the compassionate consciousness is louder than the emotional reactivity. Or if that has more strength. So again, okay, now what do we do? What do we understand? How do we dance through this limited vehicle? And like you say, the word the word in the Buddhist tradition is shunyata, when they're talking about God. Because talking about God always removes you from the reality. Like we also say, no matter how good a thing to say is, better to shut up. Which is pointing at that truth. So I think that that's one of the most interesting discoveries for me, was the realization of the unlimited depth of the compassion if I get out of the way.
It's funny, yeah. It's not like I generate any compassion. I kind of get out of the way of a profundity of care that just sort of makes it, that just is the truth of my own being. I feel it. The functions of the body mind feel it, but it isn't as if I generate it. I guess I can feel it's something about it feels good, feels true, feels healthy. I lean toward it because it's naturally attractive, but it isn't as if I'm the author of it. are in charge.
I guess what I said is it's our true nature, our relative nature. That's a filter over the top of it is problematic. And again, that conditioning. So okay, we've got the conditioning overlay. Then how do we see through it? And one of the teachings is like when you go deep enough into witnessing, you really understand that this is why I love Buddhism so much. When it was taught to me, we don't have sin, we have ignorance. The problem is ignorance and conditioning. People are behaving in a particular way because of ignorance. And another thing that I teach and really work very hard with people is say that feeling is an information system. Feeling and emoting reactive to feeling is one thing, but what are you feeling? Like you say, you're feeling angry. Well, you're acting violently. What are you actually feeling? Slow down. This is where meditation comes in. And stay with it. Is it? No one's made you react violently. What you're really going on, the deeper feeling, is you're afraid. There's a little bit of grief. Something really horrible could happen. And you deeply care. But yet the conditioning, animal reactivity, and social, political, familial conditioning says that this is a feeling that you're having as opposed to a violent intervention or shame as an interjection or disassociation, violence and suicide. So that's a whole different understanding of the nature, intention, and function of feeling. So suddenly, if you really get that and understand that, you come back to purity, what's really going on, your compassionate nature just automatically takes over. It's like you can't strike your children anymore. Can't scream at your husband or your wife anymore. It's not because you don't want to. It's because it's become inconceivable. Because you've gone deep enough into the witnessing and the clarity of mind and the spirit or the self or the soul or whatever you want to say, and have that realization. So again, what we say in Zen is, okay, back to the cushion, back to the cushion, back to the Zen, deeper and deeper and deeper. Until finally you awaken and see through the myth of your own persona. And then your whole ego becomes a technical, interesting problem instead of an emotional nightmare.
Junpo, we have a couple of people who've commented that your voice, we've turned you up as high as we can and turned me down as low as we can.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm back.
Okay, good.
I'm screaming into the night.
Thank you.
Out of the darkness into delight.
Well, and I really appreciated what you were saying there. And for anyone who had a hard time hearing Junpo, he was talking. Well, you don't need me to summarize it. Maybe better for you to.
Which part? The emotional nature?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we go deep enough into witnessing and we take a look at what's going on, slow down, and this is the whole reason that we do concentration meditation practice, not to injunct a subtle state, dream state reaction to that practice, which is a tendency of the ego to do that. And then come spirits and forms and all of these wonderful forms of entertainment. But we say, no, stop running off and come back and stay and witness and see what's going on. And if you stay present in the face of absolutely everything, something comes up in front of you, right, that you don't like, that you're afraid of, or you start to react to, and you act out at it, and you say it's made you angry, it's like take a look at the truth of the emotional body. What's really going on? So circumstances and conditions arise that are frightening or unacceptable. You feel afraid, you feel a little sad, and you really care about this, what's going on, and you react violently to do an intervention to defend or protect, or you strike at yourself because your familial conditioning, shame, you shame yourself. So you've been violent outside, or you're shaming yourself inside. You're claiming the circumstances that they're doing that to yourself. And you say, if you slow down and stay with what's going on, you'll discover that the feeling that's really going on, like I said, is fear, a bit of sadness or grief, and deep concern. And so you're going to react violently because of those what's really happening. So slowing down, understanding the actual emotional process from events and circumstances that happen, We look at them, we relate to them in a memory structure, they have to have meaning, and then we act as if. Right? And we violently do an intervention externally, internally. Right? But instead, if you stay witnessing, you see what's going on. No one has ever made you act violently as a reaction. No one's ever shamed you except you. You've done that because of memory structure that's built. So you do this reactive patterning. Well, when you see through it, it's like, no, that doesn't happen anymore. So like in Zen, we say, send me to hell quickly. I think I'm awake. Go see your family. And if you're still reacting and being abusive externally or internally, your witnessing intelligence is not deep enough. If you go deep enough into the witness and stay in the soul or the spirit or the essence place, the dhyana consciousness, you can see what's going on. The whole world changes. And you see that, you know, you are responsible for your activity. And then we say we go from there to compassion. How do you respond compassionately? So your angst becomes your liberation. Right? So in other words, that whole process is understanding the mind different. And if you need to do that, that has to be a clear intellectual philosophical understanding that can be articulated so it exists as a neurolinguistic structure so we can utilize that in reference to behavior in interaction, which allows compassion then to come back in the face of violence or cruelty. So anyway, that's the best I can do at the moment.
Yeah. I'm just finding myself feeling clearly you have a continuing sense of mission to communicate your teachings and to help wake people up and to share this deconstruction of emotional reactivity, for example.
And
so
deconstruction and reconstruction.
Uh-huh.
Deconstruction and reorientation.
Right.
Because otherwise what we have is we have a state experience, and all of a sudden then you're right back where you were. You're running the same old programs, and then what happens is meditation and concentration practice become an escape vehicle. I run over and hide there for a while, then I come back to my life, and the whole vehicle, it's the same vehicle. It's the same organization of mind and ignorant understanding. Not stupid, ignoring the truth. And I, you know, because I haven't as yet had the opportunity to have the experience and then the education that allows a whole different view. That view doesn't change. It's a stack of neurons in the brain. That has to change when we establish a new map over the old map and bring the new information in that's integrated into the map. So the same reaction now includes the conscious response. And once that's accomplished, then you've changed who you literally are. This is why I say that true practice is a ritual suicide. But how do you be reborn? You have to die. It isn't that you can maintain the integrity of the same neurotic ego hiding underneath the new enlightened being, the new awake being. That structure all has to change through discipline, compassionate, radical self-acceptance, and a willingness to change, to die so you can be reborn. And how does that all work? That's what I've, you know, spent my life doing, and now I have a language and a system that we accomplish that within. I've accomplished it personally. This Dharma is my 50 years of work I've done. This isn't my work, this is our work. All the beloved brothers and sisters that I've worked with and shared life with. We've come to this particular point where we now have a system that's pretty good.
And so your feeling is like you've given all your living, all your learning, all the wisdom and, joy and, horror, all the best and the worst of life summarizes itself to the degree that it can ever be summarized in this teaching offering. And then you're just wanting to continue to give that, even in the midst of your own neurology beginning to shut down in certain ways and degenerate. And in the midst of facing your own dying, you're feeling like giving these precious jewels as widely as you can. Am I feeding back what you mean for me to get from what you're saying?
Yes. And it's, again, this is a passionate drive. You know, I came into the world with this drive, this mission. And there's a whole lot of stories why that is. You know, there was great trouble in my being constructed in the womb. My mother and father had Rh-negative blood problems. I came in 7 months with no fingernails. My brother lived a day before me and died. My mother had 7 late-term miscarriages. So I came being created and destroyed simultaneously. Came into the world incredibly intense on this. You know, was that what set it up karmically? You know, what was my... So I'm a reincarnationist, but not outside the truth of the reincarnation. We have to go back as a Homo sapien. We'll come to the mammalian brain and the reptilian brain. We'll, oh, my God, we're all these creatures going back. And this whole evolutionary process, with that comes karmic genetic propensities and patterns of existence coming through the genetic line. So it's like, and I have children. They're not my children. They are me. You know, I am my parents biogenetically, right? And with that comes the whole social structure. So saying, okay, you know, got that. And for some reason, this passion and this mission has always been. Like when I was very young, I was about 6 years old, and I was in church one day, and I thought, I'm a priest, right? But not knowing what that was meaning. You know, I didn't want to become a Roman Catholic priest, but it was, what's this drive about? So it's for some mysterious gift of grace, right? I'm driven. And now it's driven with compassion and humor and radical self-acceptance.
Mm.
As opposed to the drive that used to be, you know, the anger that was hidden, the fear that was hidden. You know, fear is excitement and opportunity. Anger is deep care, incredible clarity of mind. It's like, okay, so wow, you know, so it's this gift of life. And then another joke you get is, you're being lived. Like there's a living body here. The ego is an interpretation or translation of existence. It's a filtration process, you know, from consciousness to matter. So it's like, wow, this is so interesting from this depth of witness. And now what to do? Hey ho, on we go. And I forget the Zen master's name, but recently, maybe 18th century or something, and he said, oh, I finally awake. Now I sit and watch my karma unfold. So it's just these endless karmic circumstances, evolutionary unfolding. We get to go.
As you're saying these things, I'm finding myself thinking about the theme of this whole series, this question about confronting, in a sense, the potential mortality of our biosphere or at least aspects of it, human-friendly conditions and maybe many, many species. You know, there's a tremendous concern among many people that we may be in some way sleepwalking partially or in some aspect of our way of being through a time when we could perhaps avert the loss of something very essential to the future of evolution. And so the mortality is always, is not just, therefore, you know, the personal mortality or the personal karma. We are able now to think systemically. My last interview was with the Buddhist scholar and philosopher David Loy, and he was talking about how the new bodhisattva has to think about the systemic causes of suffering, not just the direct experiential level, thinking in that more integral and meta-systemic way. So to simply observe the karma of the world unfolding such that it might be in the process of of a tremendous evolutionary regression, or, you know, global warming dropping the human population to a fraction of what it is now, or even wiping us out. Those kinds of things mobilize the activist in so many of us and make us feel a sense of how can I help, and feeling like we have to at least aspire to have a bigger impact. How does that relate to everything you're feeling as you work with your personal mortality? How does that relate to this larger mortality?
Well, I think the larger mortality, again, you know, what brings change, from my understanding, is pain. We don't change until we're uncomfortable in most situations. Most people don't. So, and intersubjectively, at this level, we're all getting it. We're like a virus. There are too many people consuming a small planet, and we've got this edict of growth and consumerism, consumption going on, and we're on a path that's leading to suicide, right? And science keeps telling us more and more every year, and you know that yes, these are dying, everything's dying. We're heading. We've got to change, and we're saying, well, we can't afford it. We've got to go slow sociopolitically. And it's like, so I think that the gift is that we're all starting to feel it, you know, and things are changing everywhere in the world. You know, alternative energy, healthcare. You know, everything is evolving and moving, but is it moving fast enough? And, okay, so what can I do? And we about 10 years ago, we had a Sangha meeting and said, okay, what's the first thing that we need to consider in this life spiritual unfolding? And, you know, from our perspective, and we came up with five training elements. And the first one we called was sacred stewardship. It wasn't meditation. It wasn't anything. It was, okay, then the question is, what is sacred stewardship? What do we need to be aware of? What does it include? How am I as an individual fulfilling my commitment to the stewardship? And am I acting with integrity in this chosen responsibility? How do the patterns of my consumption affect the earth and environment I live within? Or what do I spend my energy and money and time on? How does stewardship relate to community? You know, so again, that's the question that we say as practitioners. You know, are we aware, and what are we doing about it? So it isn't like, oh, everything is everything. You know, what I do is I go into escapism, or the old Arhat principle in Buddhism, which is, you know, just get out of the world, you know, just escape. The Mahayana came along and said, no, we've now that we're awakened, we got to move in and save all beings. So what do we do? What are you doing? What am I doing? I fly to Europe to lead a retreat for 50 people, 75 people, in October. I got a problem. To get an airplane and fly over there and talk to people burns a huge amount of fossil fuel, which is the problem.
Yeah.
Now, I got a beautiful truck that I bought. You know, it only gets 28 miles to the gallon. It's a hybrid, right? And I bought I used to make my own diesel fuel in Oregon, and that was part of this effort. So I bought a brand new TDI BMW, and so I'm making my own fuel. I'm getting 58 miles to the gallon. We're making soap out of the waste products, and this fuel is growing great. And a buddy of mine shows up as an environmentalist. He starts ranting at me. How did you buy that car? What did you do? And I said, at the miles, we're making our own fuel. So did you know that 70% of the energy consumed in that vehicle's life is in its manufacturing? And I went, oh my God, what, are you kidding me? No. He said, what it takes to make that vehicle, you know, is much more destructive than the time that you drive it around. So it's like, what are we doing? He said, you should have bought an old Mercedes. So what are we doing in that relationship? Where am I making the difference? I'm an organic, local, sustainable consumer, you know, philosophically speaking. Now I'm getting it that food, organic products sent in from Mexico, right? The cost of the transportation of that with environmental circumstances is more than the benefit gained from the organic. So it's like, how do I look at every direction I'm looking at what to do, what to do? And it's almost overwhelming for people. They shut down. It's too much. Everywhere I look, like, what do I do? So I said, come back and do something simple and easy. Okay. You know, what are you doing in arm's reach to come forward and do it? And not a radical victim, an angry one, but compassionately realizing and accepting this is what's going on. And it's our responsibility and our gift to bring this consciousness and joy and love back into life. So this is what we start with. We call it a practice mirror. Are you willing to honestly look at what's going on and then step into the light out of the darkness?
There we build
the whole system philosophically, practically, and emotionally of how to go about doing that. But the first point is take a look at what's going on. And where do you stand in relationship to?
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think this is an expression of the kind of consideration that so many of us are really trying to take yet to an even deeper level. And I appreciate that principle of sacred stewardship a lot. And yet I guess I find myself wanting to turn to the most intimate level, because I think, in a way, you're in a moment in which this confrontation with your symptoms and all the rest is of special tenderness and significance to me and probably to a lot of the people who are listening. And so I kind of want to circle back to that and to invite you to talk maybe in the more confessional and human way about the, you know, when something that you used to be able to do you can't do, or some part of the body it doesn't work quite the way you experience loss and then there's grief, you know, and this working with that circumstantial loss and grief in the midst of this, and it would be, I think, valuable if you can share and shine a light on how that is for you and how you're working with it.
Yeah, there's the reality, there's the physical reality of the circumstances. It's like I used to be a very serious yogi, advanced yoga practitioner, marathon runner, and, you know, all of the, you know, the physical gift of great health and well-being. And so the body now is pretty beat up and limited, right? And it's like, again, radical self-acceptance. Life and death, they're identical. The life is coming and unfolding and everything's great, and then it disintegrates and goes. So then you have your physical reaction to that, your brain chemistry changes, your psychological profile wants to jump off. So it's like you feel the grief, you feel the sadness, and open into it, right? Open into it. It's like, oh, and yes, workable. Now, what do I do? You know? So how do I change my life? How do I not try to keep repeating the past? And how do I live with the conditions that are? And how do I accept the disintegration and the devolution of circumstance? You know? Greater heart space, greater openness, greater understanding and acceptance. And it's not boo-hoo. It's like, oh, okay, and on we go. Right? So it's becoming an elder. Mm-hmm. And again, radical self-acceptance. It's the truth of disintegration. It's life and death, and from here at this point, they're the same. It's like everything's going away, and the great gift in that is the intimacy that that's now demanded. Right? I don't know when I'll be able to dance tango decently with my beloved again. I don't know that. So that shuts me down. And then I go, breathe, and show up. Okay, so now when I'm dancing tango, it's like, this is it. So suddenly, there's an intimacy and an immediacy and a willingness to open up to circumstances and conditions. Mm-hmm. So it's radical self-acceptance, appreciating and understanding, and then compassionately reaching out, continuing, living the gift of life. And it's,
do you mean compassion to yourself and to others when you say compassionately reaching out?
Compassion. Yeah. Compassion begins at home. It isn't like, oh, you asshole, why are you feeling this? You know, it's like, stop feeling it. No, feel it completely and drink it in. And then move. It's like, yes, this is sad. Okay, got it. And because of this, I now have much more attached. My heart's much more open. Like, it was just wonderful at the soup at the market the other day. There was a woman, and I was getting a little organic chicken salad for lunch, and there were 50 people in line. It was the third. And this woman came in, and I got the last of the chicken salad. She was about my age. She threw on up her face and said, oh, that's leather. I want a chicken salad. And I gave her mine. And she turned, and it was just the greatest moment, you know? You know, we can eat something else here. So it's like, it's kind of a sharing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, so there's an immediacy now to live more fully and richly. When you're young, it's like, ah, whatever, there's a lot of time. But if you radically accept the truth unfolding, then it's the great gift of death. I don't know exactly how to say that.
You said it pretty well. Thank you. I see that it's time for me to maybe invite some questions. So I'm going to offer a few announcements. And while I'm doing it, if you've dialed in on your phone, just press *2 to raise your hand. Or if you're listening on the webcast through your computer, you can type a question into the window there on your page. If you want to find out more about Junpo and his work, there are three books. There's a biography, A Heart Blown Open, by Junpo with Keith Martin Smith. There's also a book on Mondo Zen practice, The Heart of Zen, also with Keith Martin Smith. And there's an earlier book, the Junpo Roku, which he wrote with Dazu Suzanne Friedman. And all of those are available online via Amazon and the other major retailers, Barnes & Noble and others. He has a 70-day Mondo Cyber Sangha, Five Elements Practice Program, that you can find out about at mondozen.org. And that has also information on other teachers of Mondo Zen centers, retreats in the United States and Europe. And he also does private or small group two-day Mondo transmission offerings with him there in Appleton, Wisconsin, where he's living. I also want you to know a little more about me and what I do. My work is dedicated to human transformation on all scales, focusing on both the inner and the outer work. And you can find a rich body of articles, blog posts, audios, videos, events, and more, and get on my mailing list at terrypatton.com. The deepest way to work with me in person, and the best opportunity to do that this year in the United States, will be August 16th through 21st, when I'll be leading a six-day retreat at Esalen in Big Sur, California. This is where you really have a chance to go deepest with me in such ideal circumstances, one of the most beautiful practice spaces in the world. It's called Embodying the Intelligence of Your Heart and Soul. I think there are four more spaces available. I offered this program last year, and our group really we fell in love with each other, and there were also some remarkable transformational changes in all of our lives. I'll also be teaching in Cuernavaca, Mexico on September 4th through 6th, and I'll be speaking in Montreal in late September and in Paris in early October. You can find out more at terrypatton.com. And now let's take a look at the questions that have arrived. Okay. Well, first, we have a ton of questions that have come in on the Instant Teleseminar. Both Shahat and Mark from Fenwaude are sending their warm love to you, Jinpo.
Thank you.
Yeah, and there are quite a few other interesting questions that people have typed in. Some of them are very personal, and I think this is maybe the best place to go. There are some philosophical questions as well, but Greg in Solis, I think New York, says that he's been thinking lately that he needs to grieve and let go of the Earth itself, which is mortal and maybe terminally ill. My distress over the problems on the planet seem to be a projection and maybe a form of denial of my own mortality. Do you think the path to wholeness necessitates surrender to the reality that everything except spirit is already dead?
Well, already dead is... Everything is impermanent and dying. Everything is in transition. Everything is evolving. Right? It's like to radically accept the truth of the evolution of circumstance, but really go deeper, and come to the compassionate understanding of that. Right? It's like if you go deep enough into witnessing, you'll come to compassion. It's like the Dalai Lama so beautifully said when they asked about teachers that don't seem to be very compassionate. He said their insight isn't deep enough. One day I was at a conference, we went and saw him at Dharamsala. And I call it the Buddhist Winers Convention, mostly Tibetan. And a few of us Zen people went, spent 5 days with him. And he was talking about the teacher that had a problem. And they said, his insight's not deep enough. And I said, excuse me, Your Holiness, but could I be candid? He said, of course. I said, bullshit. And he laughed. It was a great time. And then he said, I know. I said, I disagree completely. His practice is profound. He's been to blah, 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 trained. And he looked at me and he said, I know you understand that, my son. And that's your understanding because your insight's not deep enough. And he was correct. So if you go deep enough to witness, you'll find the compassion. This doesn't turn you away. It's like you're engaged. It's your world. It's our world. It's our life. And you reach out. What can I do? You know, what can I do? How can I participate in the awakening and the evolution? Realizing fully that everything is in the level of disintegration. The sun is going to explode eventually, and this earth is going to become a cinder. At that point, bam. But everything continues into disappearance and absolute mystery back into formality. And our job, or not job, our gift is to be part of the witnessing of the construction and the deconstruction eternal, breathing in and breathing out, living and dying, birth and death, endlessly. Maybe not egocentrically, but endlessly, spiritually. So go deeper into your witnessing, open your heart, release fear, be with what is, radically accept the whole truth, right? And then grin and lean back in.
Beautiful. I want to ask another question from the that's been typed in. There's been some great questions typed in. Nina in Hartford, Connecticut wants to pursue that comment that you are almost returning to your theistic roots. Do you think that Buddhism, non-theism, and Christianity, theism, can complement each other? Definitely Buddhism can bring experiential meditation practice at a deep level, but can Christianity also bring something to the table just because it is theistic? Can theism deepen the Buddhist view?
Well, I think this is what we're up to now, is how do we integrate those? Like your practice, you're broad, now my practice has been broad, and then how does a language come? And what it, for me, Christianity brings the unconditional love in, right? in a very direct way. Christ was the greatest lover known to man. Love your enemies, turn your other cheek. You know, so I'm saying that depth of love, and we say, you know, I say, or that depth of compassion, not romantic love, not idiot love, not procreation love, right? But ecstatic love, deeper love, unconditional loving, right? Which includes the whole gamut. So that's what Christianity has to offer. And then what's the language about that? And how do you get into the experiential out of it as opposed to a faith-based understanding? So again, how do we integrate everything that we've realized in our understanding and bring that forward as we turn? The wheel turns. America's up. You know, the Catholicism is in a flat period of disintegration and reorganization. So it's up to us. How do we do that? What do we take from Christianity and to add to? It's our responsibility and our freedom and our gift to do that.
There are a slew of people who are writing in great questions. They include Sarah Marshank sending love, the your UK Sangha from Daiki sending you love, and a question that I find particularly provocative. Michael in Boulder asks what your view is of soul as conscious experience, as well as shadow, kind of asking you to go into these dimensions of psyche, not just shadow, but what about soul as conscious experience?
Well, again, we'd have to have a dialogue and get, again, what is his definition of soul? You know, so this is one of the problems with dialogue, is you're talking to somebody and you don't understand what the signifiers mean to them. So what is he talking about when he's talking about soul?
So well, you know, I found the question interesting, maybe because of what I would mean by soul, which is, you know, what Ken Wilber often also means, which has to do with the subtle level of being. And, you know, the radical paths like Zen have always said, don't get involved in all that. And yet, there are all kinds of questions that people have to answer in their lives, like, you know, should I marry him or her? Should I buy this house or that house? Should I take this job? Or, you know, the very specific choices, and wanting to make those decisions from the level of the deepest knowing we can. We are kind of tuning in to content, which arrives at a subtle level, and wanting to know that or understand and choose from the deepest level of our being, we're kind of dropping into something that people often call soul. To know the nature of the unique expression of your life and its purpose and its gift and its challenge and its nature, its character, is often what people are talking about when they're working with soul. So I'd be interested to hear you speak about that. I'm not sure that the questioner meant that, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, for me, soul is the silent witness within. That's my experience, my realization, my insight. Is if I go deep enough into witnessing, I'll come to absolute silence and just a radiant witness. Like right now, at the surface, there's this body, and there's this relative mind, and we're sharing ideas. And for me, this is all subtle mechanic of mind. It's all manifest formality that's fully conditioned. You know, temporarily presented the holy condition, evolutionary, organic awareness. And that is a holy condition in reference to experiences through the evolutionary pattern. So when you're talking about soul, for me, it's the pure, naked potentiality that all of this is constructed within. It's intelligent awareness. But then for anything to manifest, you've got to have a biophysical structure to develop sensing and communication, memory, and the whole function of mind. So if we go deep enough into the witnessing, right, and we go deep enough into the compassion understanding, then we're with what's unfolding. And then, okay, then what are your value system? How have you been conditioned? And so where are you taking your perspective and understanding? So you say, can I go back to the depth of intelligence, creativity at a soul level and live from that depth, right? Realizing that your whole conditioned reality is based on your genetics and your sociopolitical conditioning. Like, you know, how do you, are you going to marry? Are you going to have kids? You know, all of these questions, you know. So again, you've got to deal with the reality of the conditioned reality and then go to the witnessing intelligence and see what happens. Complicated.
Yeah, okay. Got it. Well, I think there may be some other directions that might be good to go. There are a number of people who are asking questions about being caregivers. And Ruby in Las Vegas asks, how can I, as a caregiver, be more relevant to patients on hospice, you know, who are terminally ill with less than 6 months left?
Well, we have to be careful of idiot compassion, right? So how do you, in the little bit of hospital work I've done and the people I know that are really into it deeply and that it's working for, again, this radical self-acceptance, it's to be with and to love and to support, right? So, again, how deep is your meditative understanding and your practice? And how much can you give? How much should you give? You know, it's a great mystery. It's like, you know, the zealot in me, you know. Like, how do I deal with the zealot, right? How do you deal with the zealot in thinking you're going to, you know, save and protect and defend and work with everybody and help everybody? So can you come up and be a vehicle of acceptance and radical loving support, right? And then at the same time, balance your life. So it's like, what can I do? Like a friend of mine is now taking the hospice training at Zen Center in San Francisco. He's in his 60s and he's going to retire, but he wants to retire, you know, and do that work in the world. So, you know, again, what are the circumstances that are being addressed? Where's the problem as working in hospice? So that would be the next question to whoever is saying, okay, what are you addressing?
Right. Well, one of the other questioners is asking a question on the other side of the street. He says, both cancer and nephrological issues have been part of my own path of self-discovery, and managing the life-changing characteristics that accompany these conditions has really reminded me of my own mortality. If there were one essential practice that you could suggest for me dealing with many of the same issues that you are dealing with, what would be that practice and how would I do it? This is from JD.
Well, for me, again, it's to be absolutely with what is. Radical self-acceptance. So totally accept what is and see what is and then make your decision. It's like I couldn't be where I'm at until I accepted the truth of my death. Like I'm dying. Everybody's dying. They say to people, and I get people, I got bad news for you. I'm going to be around. I had a dream and retreat a couple of weeks ago, and in it I was 110 years old at my birthday party back at Daibosasa Mountain Monastery. Was that a premonition? That's 37 years. I'm dying. So guess what, folks? You get to put up with me for 37 years. Right. So it's like, okay, so you're dying. You got the joke. Now, okay, is it going to happen soon? I made the great mistake. I took too good a care of myself. My brother laughs at me. He said, I'm going to be dead in a few years. So you're going to be dragging that corpse around for another decade or two. So how does he radically accept the truth of his disintegration? And they say, okay, then how does he share his insight with other people? You know, how does he dance the dance of death? What's the tango to the death dance? What's the rhythm and the symmetry?
Yeah, one of the things that has really moved me has been the realization that in some sense we get a chance to express our character more and more fully as we approach the end of life. And in some sense, every moment is fresh, but the trajectory of a lifetime is something of a work of art, and we're always, in some sense, expressing the character of our understanding in a fuller way by the way we deal with everything up until the last breath and beyond.
Yeah, and the last breath is the first breath. Get it. Right? You have always been. You will always be. Not necessarily this little ego. Right? The deeper realization is beyond the egocentric relative understanding. It's like you see through the myth of your being, that the temporary construct of being. It's like, I'm looking forward to death. You know? Be a nice, some downtime. You know, it's not like I don't believe I'm going to float around as a disturbed ego, right? I think I'm going to get some downtime. And then I'm gone. And do I come back? Of course I come back. But who's the I I'm talking about? I'm not talking about this particular ego. From my realization point of view, death is beyond individuality. Death is beyond this formal manifestation. What's going to happen? I don't know. You know? And like I said, I could come back into theistic organization and soul as entity that moves around as a personality, but my death experience with disintegration of mind through my experimentation with psychedelics, but then through my experimentation with heavy metal chemotherapy and radiation, this disintegration of structure, it's gone. It's dead. It's gone. I'm very changed. And now with the Parkinson's, my mind is disintegrating from a neurotransmitter point of view. Those conditions no longer exist. And when I die, they're gone. And I'm already deep into the death process. So it's like, well, okay, get it. You know, deeper spirit continues, and I'm just a representative of that reality. And I have always been. Right now, I'm talking to myself. You're talking to your very self. Everyone of us is listening, thinking they're individuals. That's from a relative temporary perspective. Go deeper into the stillness of the witness within you and hear the one great voice. And hear, taste the one great spirit. And then it's party. Hey-ho.
Aho. I want to invite a live question. There were so many typed-in questions, I concentrated on those first, but from Oakland, California, on a line that looks like it's caller ID is John Bosch. We have someone. Please introduce yourself.
Oh, yes, it's Keeson. Hello, Junpo.
Hey, Keeson. It's so wonderful that you guys are all on the call from around the world.
Well, yeah, I'm up
good
at
to
Lake
hear your
Tahoe.
Voice here.
Yeah, I'm up at Lake Tahoe looking out at the beautiful blue water. And,
great.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear your voice. I have a question, having two daughters in their 20s, one who struggles with anxiety, physical manifestations of anxiety. I'm just talking with her this morning, and I'm wondering if you have, I think this is such an obvious benefit for anyone in our 50s, 60s onward, but for someone from your perspective looking back, what advice would you give, other than practice, to somebody in their 20s about how to deal with kind of feelings of dread? Specifically for youth, how to open up in that part of your life to live as broadly and deeply as one can?
Well, so what I try to explain to people is, like, depression and anxiety, right, are reactions to feeling. I'm too depressed to get the information. What are you talking about? Answer the phone. I say emotions are phones ringing. Answer the phone. I'm suffering from anxiety. I can't answer the phone. What are you talking about? The anxiety is a conscious or unconscious way of avoiding the information. But once you understand that feeling is informational, then what is the information in the feeling? So the anxiety is preventing you from answering the phone. Slow down, breathe. Slow down, breathe. Now, could we go into it? I feel anxiety as well. Anxiety, okay, what's under the anxiety? Well, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm afraid of this. Oh, okay, now you've got it. What's the anxiety hiding? And then how do we open the door to anxiety, excitement and opportunity, right? Okay. And face what's there. So have the conversation. And this is where therapy can be really handy if you're doing the correct therapy to get deep enough to get the information. And then you can work with it. So the shift is anxiety is not problematic when you understand the nature of it. It's an insistence that you go deeper and find out what's really going on. And depression is the same. I'm too depressed. No, get it. You're finally depressed enough to be desperate enough to be willing to look at it. And in many cases, in some places it's an inability, in other places it's an unwillingness. Because if I face the truth, I'm going to have to change. The things are going to have to change. And that's too threatening. So do you get it? Your anxiety is a vehicle and a way of hiding. Your depression is a vehicle and a way of hiding. Right? So what's under there? No, it's a very different way to look. Anxiety means, okay, get a tool and pop the lid and go on in and find out what's going on. And this is where basically meditation as a concentration vehicle is critical. Your meditation practice is not for subtle state injunction in this case. What it is for the ability to stay absolutely clearly present in the face of anything. I don't hallucinate. I don't daydream. I don't complain. I return breath by breath into the impeccable strength of pure witnessing intelligence. When that gets strong enough and deep enough, I can turn to any feeling circumstance in my life. I don't react. And I investigate it all the way down. When did this begin? What the hell is going on? How do I respond? What's going on? So changing the philosophical understanding and then using it, you know, with the correct set of tools, you know, your anxiety is your great liberator.
Well, good
stuff. So you can explain. If you can explain that to them, you might get their interest.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. I needed that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Well, there are quite a few more questions, including some greetings. Bill Koth in Ashland, Jody Roberts in Plano, and
oh my God, you're going back decades and decades.
Yeah, isn't that
Bill
cool?
Koth is Bill Koth is one of the founders of the Mankind Project.
Yes, he is. And there's also Melanie in Mexico. A lot of people sending greetings, and quite a few interesting questions. In Salem, Joan wants to ask if you're making a distinction between witnessing and observation, which relates to Homer and Boise's question, which he's saying, if soul is the witness, then what's spirit? I thought spirit was the witness and soul was something more personal, so he was a little confused to hear you define soul in that more radical way.
Well, soul. When, again, it's your definition of soul. For me, at the greatest depth, soul leaves the point of individual witnessing, you might say, and comes to universal witness. Might be one way to look at it. So it's like soul is, as is currently used, is a limitation on the truth of that witness. The depth of witnessing intelligence, I'd say, as we go deep enough into meditation, suddenly becomes inclusive. It's like I was walking down the street in San Francisco one day and met this dog coming up at me, and the dog looked at me, and I looked at the dog, and suddenly there was this intersubjective relationship. It was like, oh, my God, and it was, oh, my God, from the dog. The dog's looking at me, I'm looking at the dog. We don't know who the hell is who. That, for me, is the depth of witnessing, right? Right. That's deeper than the soul reference. The soul reference in witnessing, again, is the ego claiming it. And that's not bad, but then it gets into the problem that it brings the whole definition of persona in. That my soul is a depth of witness has all these characters and traits, right? Okay, that's an explanation and a limitation of the deeper insight, or your insight hasn't gone deep enough. You're still referencing the ego as a concentration practice, dharana, but you haven't gotten yet to dhyana mind. So again, go deeper into the witnessing or the soul to come to that universal witness.
Well, thank you, Jinpo. We're getting here pretty close to the end. I do want to take one last typed question. This is from Alberto in Atlanta, and he asks, what is your stance now on using psychedelics as a tool for spiritual evolution?
My stance is the same. Be very careful. Do not allow yourself, if you're neurotic as hell, or people that you know that are neurotic, to take a powerful psychedelic, right? What happens is they can become unstable, right? And get into hallucinatory patterns that can be counterproductive and destructive. Like, I don't use psychedelics anymore because I found them to be quite adequate in my investigation and experience with them, right? Will I use them again? Possibly, right? Given any circumstances. So if you're going to do it right now in Switzerland and certain universities in the United States, they're starting to use psilocybin. Some are using LSD again. It's an incredibly beautiful and exquisite addition to the investigative process if it's done incorrect with the correct setting and circumstances and support. Right? It's not something that you do, you know, at the local bar, jumping around wildly to testosterone-driven music. Right? So it's like, how do you use it? If you can use it as a sacred medicine and an inquiry and in a structure, then be careful. And then different psychedelics have different properties and quality. You know, mescaline, ayahuasca, LSD-25, you know, these are very different compounds with very different uses and possibilities. So if you're going to do something like that, be extremely careful, investigate it thoroughly, and make sure you're doing it in a proper setting.
Thank you. Well, it looks like we've run out the clock, and there's a lot more great stuff backed up for questions, but I want to thank you, everybody, and thank you, Jinpo, and a couple of reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Jinpo Dennis Kelly Roshi, you can buy and read his books and go to mondozen.org to get on his mailing list. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my mailing list and find out about my upcoming teaching events. Thank you so much, Jinpo, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. Yeah.
You do great work in the world, Terry. Thank you so very much.
Well,
may you prosper and live another 50 years.
Yeah. Well, may you prosper and make the 37 years you've got coming more and more comfortable.
this is my full intention.
All right. So long, everyone.
So long.